Chapter 25. I can't get out of school for a second day. Now that they're monitoring him, Dad's going to be fine, Mum says as she pulls up near the gates. Don't worry. But I do. I worry all through maths, where I don't understand anything anyway, and all through science, where Miss Giles talks about adaptation. Now that Saskia's not here, I don't even have anyone to hang around with. I just sit by myself and worry. Art class is different, though. It always is. Mrs. Diver comes up to me straight away and asks about Dad. I heard what happened, she says. If you need some more time with your work, or if you just fancy coming in here at lunchtimes for a bit of quiet, that's fine by me. She smiles, and I see it's genuine. She puts her arm around my shoulder and leads me away from where I normally sit to a desk near the front. The new girl, Sophie, is already sitting there. Thought you two could sit together, Mrs. Diver says. She's trying to be nice, I can see that, trying to bring the two loner girls together. But I'm not really in the mood for talking. Sophie doesn't look very happy about it either. She looks down at the desk as she moves her stuff over to create room for me. Neither of us say anything. Mrs. Diver hands out a pile of light blue sheets of paper. Then she turns to her picture of Leonardo da Vinci and drapes her arm across the top of its frame. As you know, your major assignment for this term, she begins, is to think about flight. We will be working on capturing and then creating the movement of flying. My friend Leo here was one of the first people to be interested in a practical solution to flight. He studied and sketched the things that flew around him, and he used this knowledge to try to design a contraption or a flying machine so that humans could fly too. His artistic skills and observation helped him to understand flight, and that's what we're going to try to do too. She pulls out some pictures from under her desk and gets some of the kids in the front row to hold them. Thankfully, she skips over me. They are sketch drawings. One of something that looks like a kind of hand glider, and another of a huge parachute. There are also studies of birds' wings and bats' wings, and diagrams of how Da Vinci tried to attach wings to a human body using belts and wood. Your task, Mrs. Driver continues, is to study something that flies. You'll do sketches first, trying to understand and capture on paper the movement of how your study subject flies. Then you can use what you find to create your own flying model. You can make a simple model of whatever it is you're studying, or you could challenge yourself to use what you've learnt about flight to make a flying machine for humans, like something Da Vinci did. Your models don't have to be big, and they don't even have to fly, but I want you to think about capturing the movement of your study subject. Action. You can use Da Vinci's sketches as inspiration. She hands out copies of the sketches so we can look at them more closely. I skip over the hang glider and parachute, but look carefully at his sketches of bird's wings. I hear Sophie sigh beside me. I guess art isn't really her thing. What are you going to study? She whispers. She looks away quickly, her eyes darting over everyone else in the room, then back to me. She's shy, really shy, even more shy than me. Suddenly I feel sorry for her. I look down at the blue sheet on my desk. Choose something that flies and study its movement, it says. I could do swans, I say. I wonder about the swan on the lake. Whether she's still there. I could study her and sketch her wings easily. Perhaps I could make a flying machine like Da Vinci did, but based on swan's wings. Dad would love to have the pictures and the model afterwards. They may even lift his spirits. How will you find a swan to study? Sophie's leaning over my shoulder. Easy. I explain that Dad's a bird watcher and he's told me where to find them. I don't tell her about the swan on the lake, though. She goes back to reading the sheet. Mrs. Diver starts talking about things we could base our studies on. Bats, helicopters, butterflies. I start sketching the outline of a swan. I can't make it look like the swan on the lake, though. I draw her with her wings stretched out as if she's flying. But that doesn't look right either. After a while, I realize that Sophie's staring at me. She's holding her chin up with her hand, just watching me draw. You know, back home, the swans are black, not white, she says. She sighs again, quickly, as she turns back to the sheet in front of her. Everything's different here, kind of the opposite, even the birds. I can sort of understand what she means. Right now, it feels like my life has been turned upside down too. Chapter 26. I take my sketchbook when we go to the hospital after school. I want to draw that swan for my school project, I tell Mum. Then I can tell Dad about it later. She lets me go. I think she's so worried about Dad right now that she doesn't even really register what I'm doing. Meet you in Dad's ward in about an hour, she murmurs. I jog around the edge of the car park. I find the wooden shed and the hole in the fence. I duck through, walk quickly. There's a dampness in the air and the smell of earthy, straggly winter trees. The days are getting shorter, and it's going to be dark soon. The swan is still there. She's floating in and out of the reeds, watching me, exactly as I hoped she would be. It's almost as if she's been waiting for me. She skims her beak across the water, then points it skywards, swallowing. I tense as I remember my dream, the feel of her beak going into me. But I'm not scared of her now. I run my eyes down to her wings. They don't look broken or damaged. I'm sure she could fly if she wanted to. What's your story? I murmur. Why are you still here? I find a tree stump to sit on, then take the sketchbook from my bag and start drawing. I want her to open her wings wide like she did last time, so I can draw them for my project, but she keeps them folded on her back. I draw her anyway. The feathers are so neat across her body, each one stacked in exactly the right place beside the next. Some of them ruffle with the breeze. I try to sketch the feathers on my page so it looks like they're ruffling too. She keeps feeding, not bothered by me at all. She's ordinary today, just like all the other swans I've ever seen. The day fades into dusk. I drop my sketchbook back into my bag and clasp my arms tight around me. Stupidly, I left my coat in the car. I hold myself tighter and try to get warm. I breathe out, and my breath hangs in the air like a cobweb. I have to stand and move, or risk turning into a human icicle. I jiggle my legs and take a couple of steps. Will you follow me this time? I say. The swan cocks her head to the side as if listening. I clap my hands suddenly and loudly. She flinches, but doesn't back off. A couple of mallards take off immediately. I start walking around the track. As soon as I set off, she does too. She glides across the water towards me. I shake my head, laugh at her. You're weird, I say. What about if I do this? I break into a slow jog. The movement feels good straight away, and my body begins to thaw. I look across at the swan. She starts to beat her wings against the surface of the lake, lifting herself up. She gets faster. Her feet slap on the water until she catches up with me. Her wings are beating slowly, holding her there. She doesn't take off. It doesn't even look as though she wants to. Instead, she watches me. Come on then, I murmur. Fly! Her head is parallel to the water's surface, her neck moving like a snake. Drops of water spin out to me as she edges past. I don't stop this time. I want to know how fast she will go. I want to know if she will take off. I look at her wings, outstretched now, beating the surface of the water and creating ripples. They're so strong and strange and intricate. A perfect work of art. While the part of her wing nearest the body keeps still and firm, it's the outer half that beats downwards. They look impossible to copy, impossible to make a model of. She starts to edge ahead. I lengthen my stride, go faster. This time it's me keeping up with her. She doesn't look it, but she's really quick. It feels as if my feet are whirring beneath me as I try to keep pace. I don't know how much longer I can keep going. I look back to her face and her eyes lock mine. I stumble a little as I try to keep straight. I gasp for air. Keep running. I'm still looking at her eyes when my feet hit something. My body jerks forward, my legs tangling. I hit the track, still moving, and slide along. I'm almost at the edge of the lake before I stop. Air wheezes out of me and there's mud on my teeth. There are reeds near my eyes. I wipe the back of my hand across my face. There's blood. A small smear on my skin, a trickle running down my cheek. The swan is still on the lake. She circles back towards me and approaches the bank. I don't move. Her eyes are like dark pools of deep water, keeping me still. I get colder as I watch. She stands in the shallows and flaps her wings, sending a stench of moldy water to my nostrils. She nudges her large round body towards me. My breath comes back in a rush as she gets closer. She looks at me so intensely. It's not the way a normal bird looks at humans, all jerky and quick and scared. She's not nervous at all. Her eyes roll up to meet mine. She moves her beak until it stops a few centimetres from my nose, and I think she's going to peck me. I'm hardly breathing now. My whole body is still and stiff, waiting to see what she'll do. I just hope Harry is watching this. I need someone else to know it's real. Her beak touches my cheek. I flinch, expecting it to hurt. Instead, a bead of cool water drips from her feathers onto my skin. I feel her breath, light and cool. She smells like damp feathers and reeds. I stay stiller than a stone. She moves her beak to my neck, touches there too. I remember my dream, and half expect to feel a feather growing beneath my skin. I'm waiting for the pain, but instead I go cold, really cold. A shiver shoots down my spine. Even my fingers go tingly. I keep looking at her dark eyes. It's as if she wants me to understand something. I'm imagining this, I say, louder now so I can hear it and take it in. This isn't happening. She moves her head quickly as she hears me. I frown at her, and for a second, I think I see a glimmer of confusion in her eyes. Then she lifts her wings. Without thinking, I cower, raising my arms to protect myself. But the wings don't come crashing down. She holds them there, centimetres from my face, their ends brushing my hair. I glance over them quickly, checking for damage. There are no jagged bones pushing through, and no ruffled feathers. They're perfect. Her head moves into a kind of nod, as if she agrees. Your wings don't seem to be the problem, I say quietly, as if she could understand. She folds them slowly, moving away. She lowers her head in submission. Whatever this swan is, she's not angry at me. I stare after her as she slips back into the water. She doesn't look back. I almost don't notice the rain. It's not until the drops soak into my hair and drip down my neck that I remember how cold it is. I know, even as I'm jogging back to the trees, that I'm going to come back here. Chapter 27. I pause under the branches to shake the water from my hair. Strands of it stick across my face. I pull up my trousers to see how grazed my legs are, and roll up my shirt sleeves too. Everything stings worse than it looks. I unpick tiny stones from the cuts, then roll my clothes back down over them. I dab at my face until it stops bleeding, then I dash through the rain. I go through one of the hospital side entrances and get lucky. There's a trolley of freshly laundered hospital sheets. My trainers squeak and slip on the floor as I hurry towards it. I look around to check no one's watching, then pull a stiff folded sheet from a pile and wipe it quickly over my hair and face, then dab it against my jumper. I carry it with me as I go up the stairs. I'm still trying to shake water from my hair as I turn into Dad's corridor. I just hope the nurses won't notice how dirty I am. I press my hand to my cheek, but there's no blood there now. Harry is waiting in the hallway, leaning against the door near Dad's ward. I stop, gape at him. How did you know I was coming?
I was watching.
He glances over my muddy clothes.
You can't visit your dad like that.
He walks down the corridor away from Dad's ward, then turns to wait for me.
I'm serious.
I hesitate. I really want to see Dad. I need to tell him about the swan. But Harry's waiting for me, calling back.
Really? They won't let you in. Not the way you look. No chance. They're pretty paranoid about infections here.
I look down at the mud on my hands.
Come on, I'll help you clean up, Harry says. Then you can go back.
I trail reluctantly. He stops by the entrance to his ward and looks through the glass section.
Quick, he calls. There's no one on the desk. We can sneak past.
He keys in the numbers on the pad and beckons to me. I jog up to him and he pushes me ahead through the door. We half run, half walk to his room, Harry's hand firm on my back. It feels wrong to be in here looking the way I do, but it's kind of exciting. Harry shoves me into his room and shuts the door behind us. Then he digs under his bed and finds two towels. He chucks one at me and keeps hold of the other. He opens the door a crack, then goes out with the towel. When he returns, he's smiling.
No puddles on the floor now, he says. We're safe. I don't think anyone even took any notice of us. They're probably off getting dinner for the younger kids.
I stand there shivering. I rub the towel over my jumper and trousers and squeeze water from my hair. Harry's room is hot as an airing cupboard, and strangely, it makes me shiver even more. I clench my jaw to stop my teeth chattering. I go over to the window. It's getting darker now, but I think I can still see her there on the lake. For a second, I imagine she might be looking up here, finding me. Harry comes over with a white shirt, not too different from the school shirt I've put on.
Put this on, he says.
I stare at him. I'm not wearing your clothes. He forces it into my hands.
It's dry, at least.
He turns away from me, hops back into the bed and pulls the covers over his head.
I'm not looking.
But it's yours.
Just put it on, will you? Or you won't get to see your dad today.
His voice sounds muffled from under the duvet.
Anyway, I told you before, you can't catch what I've got.
I'm not worried about that. I glance back at the small window in his door to check that no one's about to come in. Then I go to a corner of the room. I keep my eyes on Harry's bed to check that he's not peeking. As quickly as I can, I peel my wet jumper over my head and unbutton my shirt. I let them fall on the floor. I stick my arms through Harry's shirt. It's deliciously dry, like getting into clean bedsheets. My cold, clumsy fingers fumble with the buttons. It's a bit big for me, but when I tuck it into my trousers, it doesn't look too bad. It smells of pine needles.
Thanks, I say.
I pick up my sodden clothes, feeling bad about the puddle they leave behind. Harry pops his head out from under the covers. His eyes skim quickly over his shirt on me, and I feel my cheeks reddening a little.
What do I do with these? I ask.
Easy, he says. Chuck them out of the window.
He goes across to it, fiddles with a small latch on the side, and then opens it as wide as it goes, which isn't all that far. I look directly below. There's a skip, and around it, bare concrete.
Full points if you get it in, he says.
I can't chuck my school clothes out of the window.
Well, you're not allowed to have dirty clothes in here.
He raises his eyebrows at me.
Come on, I haven't been picking the lock on that window for nothing.
He nods towards the glass.
It's either you or the clothes. You choose.
He starts laughing, which makes me laugh.
I'm laughing too hard when I throw them, and they land with a smack on the concrete.
Harry peers down.
Maternity ward will have got a shock, he laughs. They're right underneath us.
I think about all those women giving birth. Wonder if any baby's first view of the world was of my wet shirt flying past the window.
I close the window quickly, and Harry locks it again. He hops back into bed.
Thanks for the shirt, I say.
I'm about to head back out the room to catch Dad when Harry calls me back.
Aren't you going to tell me what happened out there? I was watching you.
So I do. Or I try to, anyway.
It's hard to get the words out so they make sense. Plus, I don't want to be too long and miss Dad altogether.
Do you believe me? I say when I've finished. About the swan following me and looking at me like that.
Weird things happen all the time, he says quietly. They've happened to me all my life.
He glances at his wall with its lime green wallpaper and its pictures of sailing ships and cherry trees.
I'd rather have your weird thing than my weird thing.
He looks back to the window. It's black outside now, and I can see our reflections in the glass.
So, what are you going to do next? He asks.
I sigh. If Dad had been there, he'd know what to do. There's probably a simple reason for why she was following me. A thought suddenly hits me, and I sit down on Harry's mattress, feeling stupid that I haven't asked it before. You watch that swan every day, right?
Most days. She's only been there about a week.
Have you ever seen her take off? He shakes his head. And have any other swans ever arrived? Any of her flock?
Never.
Harry pushes the covers down and crosses his legs. But she must have flown there in the first place. So why isn't she flying now?
Harry chews his lip.
She's forgotten?
That would be like us suddenly forgetting how to walk. Birds don't do that.
Some might. This one might. Are you sure she hasn't had an accident or something? Are her wings okay?
I got a close look at them. They seemed fine. No obvious broken bones.
Harry blinks slowly. His eyelids look heavy as if he's trying to force them to stay open.
Perhaps she just wanted some company, he says.
How do you mean?
Well, if I were that swan and you came to my lake, I might want that too.
As if I were her flock, you mean?
I watch a smile grow on his face.
Maybe. Birds aren't famous for their intelligence, are they?
I shake my head as I remember the intense look in that swan's eye.
She's not stupid.
Maybe she just doesn't want to fly then.
He leans over to get his glass of water on the bedside. He flinches as he stretches across.
You all right? I ask.
I'm fine,
he says, but I don't believe him. Perhaps he's just trying to look tougher than he is. I remember what the nurse said last time about not staying too long.
I better go.
Immediately he leans towards me with his eyes wide.
I'll come back, I say. Don't worry. I just need to catch Dad.
He nods at that.
I feel guilty about going, about leaving him on his own.
I'll watch her for you,
he murmurs.
Chapter 28. I hurry down the corridor. Mum's waiting outside, her arms crossed over her chest.
Where have you been? Dad's visiting hours are almost up.
Sorry, I got caught.
In the rain, it seems.
Mum looks me up and down, frowns.
I can't take you in like this, you're a mess. And where's your jumper?
I look down at my feet. Left it somewhere. Mum's mouth seems to tighten.
We'll come back tomorrow with Jack, you can see him then. Dad's tired today anyway.
But I want to see him now.
I bite down hard on my lip.
I've got things to tell him.
You had your chance, Mum says quietly.
What have you been doing, anyway?
She's so mad. She's trying to keep her voice steady because we're in the middle of the hospital corridor and there are people watching, or starting to. She walks ahead of me and I jog to keep up.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean...
She spins around. Dad was looking forward to seeing you, Isla, and you let him down just because you went to look at a swan.
But there's time now.
We need to pick up Jack from football training.
I shut up. I don't even look at her as we go through the car park. Mum's bristling with too much anger to talk to me. She drives too fast, goes through two orange lights. I fold my hands in my lap and look down at them. My stomach feels heavy, as if weighed down by a stone. Mum pulls into the car park next to the school playing fields. Jack gets in. I don't look out for Chloe behind him, not this time. I just keep my head down. Instead, I think of Dad in the hospital, waiting for me. Every inch of me feels guilty. Every mile we drive away from him feels too far. My heart is stretching like an elastic band, stretching between him and here. Something feels like it's going to snap.
Chapter 29. The next evening, I take the drawings I've done of the swan and show Dad. I pull out my mobile phone and show him the photographs I took too. He's not so pale today, and he's sitting up in bed. He doesn't look mad or even disappointed.
I'm sorry about yesterday, I mumble.
Dad shuffles between the drawings.
I'd rather you were doing these, he says. They're beautiful.
I take them back from him, embarrassed. We're studying flight and art, I say. I'm going to make a model of a flying machine like Da Vinci did, but I'll base mine on swan's wings. We have to sketch them first.
That's hard. Wings are so complex.
He reaches over to grab my hand.
I wish I could help.
I think about all the times he has helped me with my school projects, about all the good marks I got when he did. You'd be good at making a flying machine, I say. He laughs, but it's not his usual big laugh. It's soft and sad somehow.
Right now I think I need one.
He sighs heavily and turns towards the window. The sky is white as paper through the pane. I want to say something. Something to make him forget about his sick heart. So I tell him, finally, about what happened when I went to see the swan on the lake. I watch his face as I talk. She followed me, I whisper, around the lake. He hooks his little finger around mine in a fairy's handshake. At least, that's what we always used to call it.
I think that swan is just curious, he says gently. Nothing to worry about.
I want to argue with him, explain about the way she looked at me and how she towered her wings over me. But I see how tired he's looking and I can't somehow. Instead, I nod and say, maybe, because he could be right. The swan could just be curious, and I could just be imagining that there's something different about her. I pull out the feathers I took from the lake and give them to him. He holds them lightly and smooths them out as if they're precious.
Beautiful,
he murmurs, running the edge of them across the back of his fingers.
Like tiny works of art themselves.
He struggles to push himself up a little further in his bed as he looks at me.
You know, real flying machines would never work,
he says.
Not ones based on birds, anyway.
He grins, and I see for a moment that he's more like he usually is, more excited about my school project than I am. My model doesn't really have to fly, I say, reaching forward to make sure his pillows are comfortable. Anyway, why wouldn't flying machines work? He leans in to whisper.
Because people aren't birds.
I pull away and smile. Yeah, I worked that out already, thanks.
No.
He grabs my arm.
That's the problem. For one of Da Vinci's designs to work, the person operating it would need the same muscle power and coordination that a bird would have. But of course we don't.
I keep smiling. Because birds are too amazing, right? He smiles with me.
Sort of. But they've also got hollow bones and huge hearts and more muscles on their bodies than we could ever imagine.
His mouth twitches at the edge as he thinks of something.
You know,
he begins,
there's something in Grandad's barn that could be useful for you. You might think it's a bit yuck, but it's been there ever since Grandad moved in. I think it came with the house.
What is it? Dad hesitates.
Maybe you remember it from when you were young. You might not like it.
He looks up from the feathers, his mouth stretching into a yawn.
Your dad used to call him Old Swanson. Ask Grandad to show you.
When his eyes start to close, I move his cup of water nearer to him. He murmurs to me as he's slipping into sleep.
Swans are amazing, though,
he whispers.
Pretty magical.
I grab his hand again, thinking he's going to waffle off facts about whooper swans for the 50 billionth time. But he doesn't. His eyes flicker open and he gazes at the sky.
Some say swans' wings catch souls, he says.
I grasp his hand a little tighter.
What are you talking about?
He wakes up a little then.
It's a myth,
he says, nestling into his pillows.
Some people used to think that if you were dying when a swan was flying overhead, the swan would catch your soul in its wings and take it up to heaven, singing a swan song as it went.
His words drift away, and I try to get him to wake up.
What do you mean, swan song? I ask. I don't like where this conversation is going, or what it seems like Dad is thinking about.
His eyes start closing again.
It's the final song,
he murmurs.
The last thing a dying person is meant to hear. Not moans of pain, but singing. The most beautiful song ever sung.
His fingers relax in mine and he sleeps. I think about the swans flying overhead when Dad fell down in the field. Perhaps Dad was meant to die that day, and the swans that were circling were meant to catch his soul. I swallow down the sudden tightness in my throat, listen to the soft beeping coming from the machine beside his bed, his electric heartbeat.
Your soul's not going anywhere, I whisper to him.
When his breathing starts to get heavier, I take my hand carefully out of his and go and find Mum. Chapter 30. Mum and Jack are sitting on the plastic fold-down chairs talking. When are we going to Grandad's next? I ask as I join them, still wondering what Dad meant by Old Swanson. Mum turns to me.
We were actually thinking about going there now. He should know how your dad is.
Jack stands, letting the chair bang.
But we're getting takeaway first, he says. There's no way I'm eating his food again. I swear that broccoli had mould on it.
Mum doesn't smile, which is odd. Normally she'd laugh about Grandad's cooking.
Is something up with Dad? I ask.
She hesitates before shaking her head.
There's nothing new, she replies. It's just this operation he's got to have. It's pretty serious. I've been talking to Dad's surgeon and...
She swallows quickly. What? I say.
It seems there's no guarantee that Dad will survive it.
It feels like someone's kicked me in the stomach. I'm suddenly gasping for air. Mum reaches out to me.
Hey, she murmurs. Dad's strong and fit, you know that. I'm probably just worrying too much. I shouldn't have even told you.
Her eyes are digging into mine, as if urging me to stop panicking. But it's hard when I can see the fear in her eyes, too. Mum tries to smile it away.
He'll be okay, Isla, she says. He's got a great chance, even the surgeon said, so we shouldn't be worried either. I thought we'd go and tell Grandad anyway, though. It might prompt him to visit.
I look up at Jack, but already he's jiggling his legs, just wanting to move. I walk to the car in a daze. Suddenly, I don't want to go to Grandad's. I want to stay in that hospital room with Dad and never have to leave. I fling myself onto the back seat, not even bothering with a seatbelt. Mum doesn't notice. She just sighs loudly as it starts raining again. I watch the drips slide down the window, almost as if they are racing each other. Somehow, it seems right that it's raining now. None of us talk. Jack stares straight ahead through the windscreen, and the flashes of car lights in front reflect on his skin. There is a small strip of tatty-looking shops before Grandad's house, and we've never stopped there before. The only takeaway is an Indian.
Grandad will just have to lump it,
Mum says, catching Jack's look. We all know that Grandad doesn't eat takeaways apart from fish and chips. Mum and Jack go in, but I stay in the car. I turn onto my back and listen to the rain drumming on the roof. Outside, I can hear kids squealing as they jump in the puddles. There's a man's voice, too, telling the kids to come inside. Dad would never have done that. When we were younger, Dad was always outside, jumping in the puddles with us. When Mum and Jack return, they bring smells of garlic and fish and damp clothes.
We got you doll, Jack says.
He chucks a bag of poppadoms at me and I sit up to catch them.
but if Grandad doesn't like his curry, he'll have to swap.
He's got cud curry and chips, Mum explains. Thought that might be close enough.
The rain gets heavier. Someone gathers up the puddle-jumping kids and ushers them into a newsagent's. Jack reaches down to one of the plastic bags at his feet and tears off a bit of naan bread. He offers me some, but I can't eat. I'm thinking too much about Dad lying in his hospital bed, imagining him being wheeled away to his operation in a few days' time, imagining him not coming back. Mum rubs the sides of her forehead in slow, circular movements. It's what she always does before she gets a headache. As we pull back onto the ring road, Jack turns on the radio. It's tuned into Mum's talkie station. A man with a deep, boring voice is talking about bird flu.
"The illness has already killed 35 people in India," he's saying. "Experts warn of it spreading to epidemic proportions."
I try to block it out. I'm sure this is the last thing any of us want to listen to. But for some reason, Jack doesn't change it. He just drums his fingers against the window. When the man starts talking about a suspected new outbreak in Bangladesh, Mum pushes the windscreen wipers to a faster speed. Jack reaches back to grab a poppadom.
"Why didn't you see Dad yesterday?" he asks.
Mum flashes him a warning look. I don't answer him. I feel bad enough as it is about missing Dad. I don't need him to make me feel worse. But Jack doesn't give up.
"Were you seeing that boy again?"
There's something nasty about the way he says it. I can hear his anger.
"Well, you were playing football," I mutter.
Jack's eyes narrow, his mouth goes tight, and I can see him thinking of something to get at me further.
"Is he your boyfriend?"
he taunts. "Don't be stupid." I grab the bag of poppadoms and chuck them at his face. They smack hard against his chin. He won't give up now. He picks off a bit of poppadom from his chest and leans over the seat.
"So you chose to see some sick boy over visiting Dad?"
"I didn't mean to." I launch myself at Jack, try to punch him over the headrest. I thump my fists into his shoulder and kick the back of his seat. As Jack turns to grab my arms, the poppadoms go flying to the dash. Mum lashes out at Jack, tries to stop him.
"Enough!"
she yells. Jack stops, lets go of me.
"You're such an idiot,"
I hiss, rubbing my skin. I wait for Mum to tell him off. I look at her when she doesn't. Normally, when Jack and I kick off, she's the first to react. She can shout louder than everyone in the family put together. But not tonight. Tonight she's like a robot, staring straight ahead and blocking us out. Jack follows my gaze and notices her expression too. He turns back to the front slowly and shuts up. Mum turns up the volume on the radio. I press one ear against the cold window, but I can still hear every word. The man is interviewing someone about how bird flu killed her husband. They cut to the sound of swans honking. I think they're a flock of whoopers. There's the sound of a gun going off. Another swan honking. The flap of wings. I don't want to listen. I want to open my window and let the words and noises escape, but it's still raining outside. I'm about to lean forward to turn the radio down myself when I notice Mum's face. It's all crumpled looking, and there are tears on her cheeks. I freeze, just watching. I don't know whether Mum's upset about Dad, or the news report, or about Jack and me fighting. I almost lean forward and grab her hand, but she seems so separate from us, almost as if she's driving in a different car. I glare at the back of Jack's head, wanting him to say something. He's the older brother after all. But none of us do. We drive the rest of the way to Grandad's, in silence. Chapter 31. Grandad picks out bits of fish and wipes the curry sauce off them. He smells each forkful before he puts it into his mouth. "Do you want the rest of mine?" I say, pushing my plate towards him. His forehead only wrinkles in annoyance. Mum waits until we're all quiet.
"Graham's going in for a valve transplant," she says. "It's pretty serious."
Grandad's eyes flick across to me and then Jack. He chews carefully on the fish.
"Aren't you worried?"
Mum asks eventually, her voice harder sounding than usual.
About your son?
Grandad swallows his mouthful, runs his tongue over his teeth.
I'm sure he'll pull through. He's a tough lad.
Maybe so, she says quietly, but he'd appreciate a visit. Grandad's face goes red then. For a moment I'm worried he's going to choke. He even starts to cough a little.
I don't like hospitals, he says.
He's been saying that a lot lately. Mum's not impressed, though. She clatters her knife and fork onto her plate and glares at him.
You know, she starts, Beth's illness was serious, Martin. It wasn't the hospital's fault.
Jack exchanges a look with me, and I know what he's thinking. No one mentions Nan in front of Grandad anymore. We all know how upset he gets. But Mum doesn't wait for him to react. She just grabs his plate and storms into the kitchen. He blinks at us, his jaw pulsing at the sides. Mum scrapes the rest of Grandad's meal into the bin, then starts to do the washing up really loudly. Glasses and plates clink together as she thumps them all onto the drying rack. Jack leans backwards on his chair.
Want a hand?
He calls out to her. He just wants to get away like I do. But Mum doesn't answer. Jack slowly pulls his chair back from the table and goes over to the TV. He channel surfs. Grandad feeds the rest of the poppadoms to Dig. He doesn't look at any of us, but I see the poppadoms shake as he holds them out. Jack settles on some American sitcom, where there are beautiful girls and guys arguing in a restaurant. It's exactly what Grandad wouldn't want. He flinches when the canned laughter comes on. What makes it worse is that Jack starts to laugh, too, at all the really unfunny bits. It's not Jack's normal laugh. I think he's forcing himself to enjoy it. Grandad grips the table so tightly his knuckles go white. He's so tense now that he's starting to look unwell. I lean towards him, try to get his attention. Dad said there was some stuff in your barn, I say cautiously. Things that might be useful for a school project I'm doing. He said something about old Swanson? Grandad looks over at me, his face still red.
Did he?
He keeps frowning.
Beth found Swanson, he says, in the back of the barn when we moved in.
I shut up then. The last thing I wanted to do was bring up Nan again. Grandad scrapes his chair back.
You're welcome to it, though,
he mutters, walking away from me.
I suppose it's all just a pile of rubbish now.
He flicks a glare at Mum in the kitchen and heads towards his conservatory. He shuts the door behind him and stands in the dark. I sit by myself at the table, listening to all the unfunny lines from the telly. Then I grab my coat from the back of my chair. I shut the back door behind me and lean against it. I take a deep breath of the cold air, then walk carefully down to the barn. It's got dark since we arrived, and the only light to see by is the moon. I draw back the cold, rusty bolt that fastens the large metal doors. It's even darker inside. There could be anything, or anyone, hiding in the blackness. I run my hand along the wall, my fingers scraping on rough wood, and find the light switch. The barn is suddenly huge. I'd forgotten how big it is. There is still a row of stables to one side that used to be part of Grandad's vet practice. But instead of horses inside, there's a couple of old rusty bikes leaning up in them now. The rest of the barn is jammed with crates and furniture and old farm equipment. Lopsided heaps of magazines and books. Sagging boxes. Stuff Grandad no longer wants. Dirt and memories. I have no idea where to start looking. Nothing seems to have anything to do with birds or flying machines. I almost give up, but I don't want to go back to the house yet either. I pick a path through the debris and find a box labelled Graham's School Books and Photographs. I don't recognise the handwriting, so it must be Nan who wrote it. I trace my fingertips over her letters and try to remember her. She was smiley and energetic like Dad, and she'd always greet us at the door with the smell of something cooking in the kitchen. It was always fun coming here. There was always so much to do. Dad used to drive us over all the time. Before Dad, it was Nan who used to tell me about the swans. I suppose I miss her, just like Grandad does, although my memory of her is patchy and blurred. I can remember how she died, though. She had something wrong with her heart, like Dad. She went into hospital for an operation and got some sort of virus. She never came out. When Dad got the phone call from the hospital, he turned pale and clung onto the receiver for ages. I lift the lid of the box and look at the loose photographs inside. There is a picture of Nan in a flowery dress, and a picture of a younger and taller Grandad standing next to a horse. There are pictures of Dad, too. One photograph is so crinkled and thin, it could almost be a piece of exercise paper. Dad looks really young in that photo, but he's got the same brownish-blondish hair that he still has now, and there are a pair of binoculars around his neck. There's a hand on his shoulder, belonging to someone just out of shot. Grandad, maybe. Dad's smiling, as if he's having the best day of his life. I walk on. Further down the barn is a dusty steel operating table and a skeleton of a horse. I touch its cool, dry bones. I flip through a couple of posters about animal body parts. Then I see it. It has to be what Dad meant. It has to be old Swanson. I walk towards it. Its eyes stare back at me, unblinking. I crouch down and touch its glass cabinet, wipe away some of the dust. I can remember this now. It used to give me nightmares when I was young. I used to dream of it coming alive and chasing after me through the barn. It's only stuffed. I can still remember Nan's voice too as she explained it to me. She laughed and cradled me to her. This bird's not going to be chasing anyone, that I can promise you. She'd placed it back in the shadows of the barn. Silly old useless thing, she'd murmured. It looks different to how I remember it. Less scary somehow. More like something you'd find in a museum. I trace the outline of its wings on the glass. I can tell by its large black beak that it's a male mute swan. Its wings are outstretched and pinned to the back of the cabinet, mid-wingbeat. They're huge, beautiful. Its glass eyes aren't creepy in the way I remember. They just look lifeless and sad. Nothing like the intense eyes of the lone grey whooper at the lake. I wonder how I could use this for my project. I almost laugh. I wasn't going to make a life-size model, Dad, I murmur. But looking at these wings now, perhaps I could. Perhaps I could attach some wooden planks to the bird's body and make a kind of hang glider with wings. It's a bit odd, but it might look like those Da Vinci sketches, and Mrs. Diver would love it. The cabinet screeches as I drag it along the floor. I rest it against the edge of the old operating table, underneath an electric light. Then my head turns as I hear Mum yelling for me. She's outside on the path to the barn. I hear her quick footsteps near the door. I stand up, waiting for her. She blinks as she steps inside, looks confused until she finds me. Come on, it's time to go, she calls over. So I give up on the stuffed swan. For now, at least. Chapter 32 I dream of wings that night. Huge, powerful white wings. I dream they flap all around me, hundreds of them, beating around my head and body, touching my skin and clothes, growing out from my back. They beat so fast that a cyclone whirls up around me. My hair fans backwards. I shut my eyes against the wind and the cold, and I spin off into the night, held up by all those feathers. Chapter 33 The first thing I see is Harry's shirt. I've left it on the back of my chair, ready to return to him. I get up and hunt around for one of my ordinary school shirts, but I've used them all. They're sitting in the clothes basket downstairs. Doing the washing was always Dad's job. Since he's not been in the house, none of us have even been near the washing machine. I pull Harry's shirt off the chair. Can I get away with it? I thread my arms through its sleeves, tuck it deep into my trousers. I don't have anything else. I hang my school tie loosely around my neck, cover it all with my spare school jumper. I have to wear my muddy trousers from the other night. As I go down the stairs, I realise that I like having Harry's shirt on. It makes me feel different somehow. When he gave it to me, I thought it might be weird to be wearing a sick boy's shirt. But it isn't. It kind of feels like I'm hiding a secret, but it's a nice secret. It still smells faintly of pine needles. I brush at my muddy trousers as I go into the kitchen, try to pick off some of the worst patches. Jack's already there, shoveling his breakfast in. "You're in a hurry," I say.
"Playing football before school, meeting the others."
"Can I come?" I say without meaning to, before I even know why I'm asking. Already I can see him trying to work out how to say no nicely to me. I sit down opposite him, pour myself a bowl of Rice Krispies. I tip the milk in and mix everything around until I can hear the Krispies crackle.
"Why do you always want to come?"
he asks. He's suspicious now, looking at me funny. I stir my spoon through my cereal. I don't know. I think of his friends sitting together at the playground, the way they always seem so tight. I think of Chloe. No real reason. Jack shoves his last mouthful in, then clatters his spoon into the bowl. He sighs as he looks at me.
"It's not Chloe, is it? You don't like him, do you?"
"Course not." I say it too fast. I feel my cheeks go hot and red and stick a spoonful of Krispies into my mouth so I don't have to say any more. Jack notices, though.
"Ha! Knew it!"
He throws his arms up into the air.
"What is it with that guy?"
He frowns as he tries to work it out. Then he gets up from the table, turns as he has another thought.
"So it's not just sick boys you like, then?"
On the way to the sink, he stops to hold his spoon above me, waiting for a bit of milk to drop off and land on my neck. I flinch to the side. "Get off me!"
"Bird's got a crush," he taunts in an annoying sing-songy voice.
"I don't," I say, "because I don't have a crush on Chloe. At least I don't think I do. No more than any other girl in my school. Anyway, it's Harry I've been thinking of lately." I turn and snatch the spoon from Jack's hand before he can drip any more milk onto me. "He's just the nicest of your loser friends." I fling the spoon towards the sink, only it doesn't get there. It pings off the worktop and hits a glass, which topples and then starts to fall. Jack dives for it, catches it, just.
"Hey, didn't mean to make you mad,"
he says, laughing now.
"I just think it's funny. First this sick boy in the hospital, and now Chloe. Settle down, sis."
He washes the spoon, then comes back to the table. He's smiling, but his eyes are still taunting me. "I don't like either of them," I say. "Not like that." Jack raises his eyebrows. I'd hate to know what horrible things he's thinking about me. If Dad was here, he would have told Jack off by now. He gets up from the table, grabs his school bag. "Don't you dare say anything to your friends or anyone!" Jack stops, half turns.
"So you're saying it's true?"
I shake my head quickly. "As if!" He chuckles as he takes an apple from the fruit bowl.
"Go get your own group of friends. Chloe's mine."
He's smiling as he says it, but it still stings. I pat the Rice Krispies further into the milk until it all turns into one big soggy mess. Then I get my sketchbook from my bag and draw wings until it's time for Mum to take me to school. Chapter 34. Mrs. Diver gives us the whole lesson to work on our flying projects. She walks between our desks, checking our ideas.
"Once you've completed your studies on paper, you can start on the model," she says. "Remember, it can be based on something real that flies, or you can design a flying machine like Da Vinci's. Your models don't need to be big, and you can use any material you like."
I think of old Swanson, and wonder if that's the kind of thing Mrs. Diver means. A large stuffed swan hardly seems top of the standard list of art materials. I lean back on my chair and wonder how to use it. What about the wooden hang glider idea with the swan attached? It wouldn't have wheels and gears like Leonardo's machines, but if I got it right, it would look pretty amazing. Only it would be huge. Mrs. Diver jolts me out of my thoughts. But before you start thinking about your model, she says quietly, I want you to continue doing your observation sketches.